Welcome to the RBMS Streaming Podcast, a podcast that explores the stories about the people, the places, and the work within integrated catchment management. My name is Janice Taylor of the River Basin Management Society and your host today. In this episode, we meet Ngiyana woman and chair of the Muddawarra Fitzroy River Council, Dr. Anne Polina, to discuss the future of the Muddawarra Fitzroy River in Western Australia. Stretching 700 kilometres across the Kimberley region, fed by 20 tributaries across the lands of seven different Indigenous nations before emptying into the Indian Ocean, this nationally heritage listed river is the largest Aboriginal cultural heritage site in WA. A sacred ancestral being for all traditional owner groups who belong to the river and its systems, there's a great deal of concern about the proposed management of its surface and groundwaters. Here to tell us more about the past, the present, and the future envisioned for the Muddawarra is Dr. Anne Polina. Welcome, Anne.
Mabubara, ngajinu nilawala and Polina, ngayo imadawara man, and ngay mandajara nyigina ngay nyigina nganga, and I'm just saying good day in my nyigina language, and what I'm saying is that my name is Dr. Anne Polina, and I'm a woman who belongs to the Fitzroy River. So, lovely to be here with you today, Janice, and talk and share with your listeners. So thanks for the invitation.
Thank you so much for joining us. I'm really looking forward to this podcast, so it'll be great if we could start off with letting people know a bit more about yourself.
Yeah, no, that's right. I guess it's really interesting because several months ago I did a podcast because everybody's got a view who Anne Polina is, but I thought it was time for Anne Polina to let people know. So my background is, as I said earlier, I'm a woman, a traditional owner, a custodian, guardian of the Fitzroy River. I'm Ngiyana and Warawa. My family have been here since the beginning of time. My great-grandmother was brought into a wonderful place called Nookanbar in the late, mid-1860s. There was a huge massacre on her country and most of her family were decimated, and she was brought into Nookanbar. So from Nookanbar, she fell in love with an amazing man who gave her children his name. And so my grandmother and was born, and so I've got a history of being well connected to the Fitzroy River. My grandfather was more down in the lower part of the river. So I guess this is one of the things about complexity is you can't change who you are. So my identity is created from the Fitzroy River. And as I said, I'm a traditional owner. In terms of my background, I've done a lot of things. I originally started in nursing, but since then I've moved into education and research. So my background is I'm a multidisciplinary scientist. I've got a master's in public health and tropical medicine, a master's in education, a master's in Indigenous social policy, a PhD, and just finished another PhD. So
wow.
Understand the value of knowledge. Yeah, understand the value of knowledge. And it's more like the more you know, the more you don't know. So I appreciate having that diverse background because, as I keep sharing with people, we're dealing with complexity. So we need collective wisdom and all different types of people that can work together with the spirit of goodwill to look at how we manage our amazing river systems, because rivers are under stress right across the world. You hear stories about the number of rivers that no longer flow. And I think one of the big things about the work that I do is that I've been constantly creating dialogue between rivers, because they are living systems. So yeah, so in terms of that, right now I'm also an adjunct professor at Notre Dame University here in the Broome campus. I'm also a visiting research fellow with the Australian National University Water Justice Hub, and I hold a senior research fellow position with Charles Darwin. So
wow.
You know, continuing to sort of stay connected and create these networks and learn and share. I sit on the State Aboriginal Water and Environment Group. I share that space at a federal level with amazing people like, you know, Brad Mogridge and Phil Duncan, and really great people who are looking at how do we have a new way of being in dialogue one with each other, but looking at how do we manage our amazing catchments and nature reserves and bioregional frameworks. So yeah, all good.
That sounds like that's a lot of your time taken up. You sound like a very busy woman doing amazing work across the whole nation. So we're really grateful to have you here today. And it'd be great to learn a lot more also about, as a Nigiyana woman of the Fitzroy River, like what does that, its surface and its groundwaters mean to you? What's your connection to the river? Like, how are you tied to it?
Yeah. Well, you know, as I said, Ngāyu I Māruara, I belong to the Fitzroy River, so I am under a law of obligation to protect that river's right to not only life, but the river's right to live and flow. So my family, you know, we have a beautiful little place on our traditional lands that my grandfather and grandmother established, and we've been there for many, many generations. And building a wilderness centre, creating space for dialogue, opportunities to publish and write about luxury tourism, which is not five star, but the opportunity to go with Aboriginal people to be on country and feel country, and particularly for our fellow Australians, is to feel the country that they're from because they're part of it. And I think this is one of the things that we're saying with the Fitzroy River is that it's National Heritage listed.
Yeah.
So it belongs to all Australians. It's a very, very precious place. It's an amazing place. And, you know, it's very special. The other point was it's the largest registered Aboriginal cultural heritage site in Western Australia. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've been told never, ever again would we destroy something so amazing as the first form of human thought, which was what we exploded when we blew up the Juggan Gorge cave. So it's a very precious place, and we've been the guardians and the carers of this system from the beginning of time. And now all of a sudden there are huge demands to look at development in the region, and how do we do that in a sensible way? How do we learn from the Murray-Darling Basin to not make the same mistakes? How do we share with the people over there who live on country and work on country? You know, like, I've got a very, very extensive network, and, you know, like Rob McBride's there, and Badger, and, you know, lots of really good people. And at the moment they're a little bit under stress with COVID and things like that. But our rivers and our living water systems are amazing things. And we say that country is alive, that these rivers are alive, that they hold memory. And so what we want is for people to fall in love with their rivers, fall in love with their living water systems, and get to know place-based, you know, where they are, where they're at, and get to feel the country. And this can be for people in the city as well. I mean, the Yarra is right there, and, you know, most of our cities have got beautiful waterways running through them. So we're really encouraging our fellow Australians to fall in love with what we call living water systems, because we haven't gone with the cultural flow conversation, because, as I said, we see water as a living spirit, that it's alive. And, you know, so do people over east and across the planet. But we've been very cautious about really framing it as land and living waters and people, because, as you know, Emma, I mixed you up with Emma Carmody, who's also a brilliant person. But Janice, one of the things is Indigenous people don't separate land, water, people.
Yep.
They're all intrinsically entwined. And I think one of the big issues is the failure of our policies, and to be able to look at how do we come together in an integrated, holistic way to look at land and water resource management, with keeping people at the heart of their decisions and not just big business.
Yeah, no, and we 100% agree with that sort of concept of everything is interconnected and intertwined, and to have good governance and good planning as well, and decision making, that there definitely has to be those conversations and learnings had across all people who love, and hopefully everybody loves, our rivers. So that's fantastic, everything that you are doing. And part of that means that you're involved in a lot of organisations. I've got here that you're deputy chair, so you're of the Northern Australian Indigenous Land and Sea Management Alliance, and you're also involved in the Indigenous Water Policy
Group.
It's
interesting. I mean, that was almost 10 years ago now, how quickly time moves. But I've stayed connected with NALTMA. You know, there's great people up there. They're also obviously in Northern Australia, so they're looking at land water development.
Yep.
There's some very big issues in the Northern Territory that people are looking at in terms of, you know, and we'll come back to it possibly, the Strategic Aboriginal Reserve. What does that mean for Aboriginal people? So, you know, the Northern Territory has been leading a lot of the development across Northern Australia around land and water, particularly from a collective Indigenous voice. So they're an amazing entity, and the leadership, the water leadership, the water governance that comes from NALSMA is second to none. So it's great. And you know, like my thing is that, you know, sometimes we get on these committees, but it's also time to move to the side and bring some of our younger, more creative and critical thinkers into those leadership positions. So I tend to sort of get on board with these sorts of things and make, you know, probably a couple of years of commitment, and then look at how do we nurture our younger emerging leaders, particularly in the water space, and make room for them. So there's amazing, you know, younger leadership coming through NALSMA. But and it did have the Indigenous Water Policy Group there, which I was chair of for a part. So, yeah, you know, a lot of that is, as I guess, it's not that I'm so busy and moving around and so high qualified. It's the network, the cost benefit of networking and working with amazing people, because, as I said earlier, we are dealing with complexity. So we need to have a lot of different systems thinkings, lots of different ideas, and agree to disagree. And you know, so long as it's evidence-based, we shouldn't be too emotive about things.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, a part of that is that you're part of the, you helped form the Marawara Fitzroy River Council. Is that correct? As part of
No, it's an interesting story, because in about 2016, many of the Indigenous organisations, what they call the prescribed body corporates, or the governance bodies for our traditional owner groups and, you know, community people, came together on the banks of the Fitzroy River in 2016, and we made a declaration to the river, really, but to the world, that we needed to protect the Fitzroy River, because obviously it has been, you know, on the public agenda for quite some time, in terms of people dreaming up water stories about how they're going to do something and move around and, you know, do different things with the river and to the river. And this has been happening basically since 1838, when the settlers first came to the region. And I think one of the things I want to encourage our listeners is to get on board and have a look at the Marawara Fitzroy River Council website, because one of the things on that website is there's access to a lot of amazing publications. So what you'll see on there is a report written by Dr. Magalie McDuffie, looking at, you know, what were the settler diaries saying when they came to the Fitzroy way back in, you know, 1838, Magalie has a starting point of, in terms of, very, very interesting, because the settler diaries talk about things like, oh, we could see, you know, smoke fires burning and people laughing. And when we looked and came upon them, they were roasting duck and pigeon and, you know, in a world, building a picture of utopia. And what Dr. McDuffie's report does is that it shows that within 150 years, we've gone from, you know, the world of utopia to abject poverty and despair. We have the highest suicide rate in the world, and a lot of our young people are looking for hope and wondering, you know, when is it going to be their turn to have investment and build their capacity and take them on a journey so they can reach their full potential as human beings. So there's a lot happening in the Kimberley. So from that perspective, 2016, I also had... at the same period of time, a few months later, the Tribunal for Nature, which was the first Tribunal for Nature, which was held in Brisbane. And we brought the Marawara Fitzroy River to that, in terms of this, you know, Marawara Fitzroy River versus the state of WA and the nation. And it was a very, very interesting process, mainly to open up dialogue, but to hear the stories of other people who are defending their environment and, you know, and looking at what are the alternatives. We can't continue to have business as usual. So from that perspective, we came back, we had a very big meeting. And at that time we had lots of conversations happening, and I'm jumping now to about 2018. So one of the last meetings that we had collectively, in terms of all of the stakeholders at the table, one of our senior men who just passed away this year, he rose really quietly in the room, and he stood up and he looked at everybody debating and carrying on, and he said, "You came, you stole the land, you made us slaves, and now you are back for the water. What is going to be left for blackfellas?" And so it's a really, really important point, is that we have been the guardians of this river system from the beginning of time. We laugh with it, we cry with it, we dance with it, we sing with it. So it's a very deep ecological relationship and an ethics of care and love that we must pay our full attention to, but we are bound by a law of obligation to look after the river and to make sure it is there, not just for Indigenous people, because this is something that we're saying very, very clearly, is that this river belongs to everyone. It belongs to the fishermen. It belongs to the recreational campers who come and camp with their family. It belongs to the scientists who come and have had a relationship with it. So what we're saying is that we are not, as Indigenous leaders and carers of this river systems, going, oh, this is just for Indigenous people, all you others go away. What we're saying is that how do we collectively work together and look at how do we manage this system for now, but also for future generations to come? Because it is a very, very scary story when you look at the Murray-Darling Basin and to see, you know, how much investment's been there. And in a way, one of the things that is really scary to me is this concept of foreign investment and foreign ownership in water. And, you know, reports coming from the ACCC that says it's pretty scary because you don't even need to have an ABN to trade water. So, you know, there's a lot of rules that I think need to be made transparent. I always go, you know, looking at things and I go, oh, it's an illusion of probity. There's a pretense that we're going to do things the right way, but really there's another story underneath. And, you know, there could be a lot of bad will rather than goodwill being produced in terms of, you know, trying to do deals under the table, trying to trick traditional owners and other people who live in the region about what the intent of, you know, business and potentially government could be.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I wish everybody could see through your eyes the way that to move forward as a collective is it's how it should be. And I don't feel like that's how it's well represented in our current governance type models. A lot of things are through like consultation periods. They're quite brief. The consultation period at the moment that just closed for the paper, I think, was it that you can't even see the submissions online that were put through forward?
Look, this is a really interesting question you're posing, Janice, because it's about transparency and accountability in government. Because one of the things I noted, and I'm referred back to the Aboriginal Cultural Heritage Bill and to the Juggan Gorge Inquiry, is that these were public submissions and they were made available to the public. So individuals, groups, stakeholder groups could get on board and have a look at people's submission and see where was the body of evidence, or what is the body of evidence that people are advocating to give the position that they have. And it allowed people to read it. And sometimes, you know, it was very, very revealing. I read many of the previous submissions and I go, oh, I never thought of that. So I'm a little bit disappointed that the submissions for the Derby Draft Water Allocation Plan, which you'll hear that word, Draft Water Allocation Plan. So there's already a consideration from government about how a water plan would sit within the Shire of Derby. And then we've got the greater discussion, which is around a discussion paper for the whole of the Fitzroy catchment. And that's also there as well. And I think there's a lot of people in the region, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous, who do not know what is actually going on. So this is what I'm saying, is that really we should have had almost like traveling exhibitions and talking to community and that, because one of the things about the Kimberley is that it's diverse, but it's also geographically large. I think we could put Tasmania in here about three times. So it's a very, very big place. And so it costs money to get out and have true consultation. And this is what we're saying with government, with the development of all of their legislative changes, is that consultation does not mean consent. Consultation means, okay, let's negotiate. How do we co-design our frameworks going forward? What is the greater good, particularly of our commons? What is the greater good of our commons for the greater common good rather than the common good of a few greedy frogs? So what we're very cautious about is that some of those big greedy frogs have come across from the Murray-Darling Basin and they're now locating themselves within the Fitzroy River catchment. And what I'm saying is that no development project should be off the table. Before we start talking about how we're going to cut up the water, I think the critical element in all of this, particularly from what I've seen at the Murray-Darling Basin, is we seriously need a way to have transparency and good governance. So good governance, good water leadership, good water governance, which is integrated with land and people, really needs to be the basis of how we move forward before we start talking about cutting the water up and this is what's going to happen. And, you know, the illusion that, oh, we promised no dams, but, hey, maybe we can have floodplain harvesting. Now, floodplain harvesting, when you look at what's happened in the Murray-Darling Basin, what we're being told is exactly that, that floodplain harvesting is really another form of water extraction. So we need to be very, very tuned in. We really need to understand the frame and the intent of government and big business. But most of all, I think one of the big things that I was a bit concerned about and other people are concerned about is the lack of climate science that's backing up where and how we go forward. Because, you know, one of the things is I live on my community and many other Aboriginal people live on their communities. And particularly in the time of COVID, COVID has shown us that we really need to look after, our amazing biodiversity, our land, our living waters and all of those things, because they do sustain life. So one of the things that we've noticed, that I've noticed over the last 10 years, is the direct impact of climate change in regards to water security, the lack of it, the lack of food security because the systems are all out of whack. The trees aren't flowering when they're meant to flower and produce fruit. So all of these things are really, really important because we are being impacted on by climate change right now. So to take water from the system or our living water systems, for profit is a real big question because we need to make sure our living waters are alive. One, because it contains spirituality and cultural values that we hold dear to, but these are living systems and they have a right to have that resource as well. So from our point, from the Murrawarra Fitzroy River Council point, one of the questions you asked me before was, what is it? Well, at the moment, it is an amalgamation of six different native title groups that have come to stand in solidarity. And that was the, in a way, the vision that was given to us by the senior elder when he stood up in the room and had said those things, what's going to be left for blackfellas, is that he has given us instructions that we must be united, that we must stand with one voice. So when you see our logo, it says one mind, one voice, so that we are all informed, that when we go to a decision-making process, we can come from an informed basis and we can be united in the decisions going forward. So very, very important that we look at this from a collective. So the representation on the Murrawarra Council goes from the top of the catchment all the way down to the mouth of the sea, but also importantly, the connectivity, the connection between freshwater, saltwater interface. So we also have Aboriginal communities that live on the peninsula who are not members of the Murrawarra Council, but have been watching our work saying, well, that water runs down and we're connected. And at some point we need to have a dialogue, a conversation about how do we all work together? Because one of the things, as you know, is that I'm connected to amazing water scientists, and some of the information that we're seeing is that water not only runs down, it also runs sideways. So whatever happens on the Fitzroy River catchment will have a connection and an impact on those communities that live on the coast. So it's really, really important that when we're doing our research, when we're making our decisions, that we consider the connectivity between freshwater, saltwater interface. I mean, you've heard some of the rhetoric out there by some of the developers saying that, oh, the water from the river is just, you know, going out to sea and it's wasted water. But, you know, this is the largest macro tidal delta in the world. So there is definitely an interface between saltwater, freshwater relationship. And it's an amazing place. And we really need to look at how do we care for this from as a global asset, not just as a national asset.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. And you're correct in saying that with climate change and with these proposed extraction, I think they've got of up to potentially 300 gigalitres a year of surface water and 109-ish or so of groundwaters within the Fitzroy River catchment. Though any impact will change the river and how it lives and breathes and functions like over time. So if they, however much they do take will impact its dry season, its wet season, the whole connectivity of the system. So it really seems like, I don't even know where these sort of estimations have come from in terms of where they come to this number. And then they've only said about 30% set aside as part of a Aboriginal water reserve. How did that sort of make you feel in terms of they're trying to say this is all for economic development, but really at the end of the day, it's the whole life and the health of the system. And if that's impacted over profits and helping others sort of establish more of a business or whatnot, it's going to be quite a tragic story.
Yeah, our job, Janice, is to not let it become a tragic story. Our job is to challenge ourselves as decent thinking human beings about how do we get this right. I think one of the most important things is, you know, as you said, people are trying to land on a number in terms of 30% of this and 30%. What we're talking about is 30% of the consumptive pool. And what we're saying is that I think we need to slow down before we start counting and start to get the governance mechanism right. What is the framework? And my advocacy has been towards a legislative framework, so it's embedded in legislation so that we can have certainty and rigor in terms of our decision-making around water and water leadership. So at the moment, this figure has been plucked out of the air, 30%, but it's been plucked out of the air from the Northern Territory, which has a total different basis in terms of land. They're talking about land rights in the Northern Territory, and this story here in WA is really focused around what's our native title rights and interests and how do we redefine native title, particularly from a water right perspective. So at the moment, I don't think it's reasonable or rational to say, let's take something from somewhere else and make it your precedent. So we haven't landed on a number because, as I said, we're very, very keen to make sure we get the governance mechanism right. I think one of the big issues is that with a recent conversation with the Productivity Commission and the National Water Initiative, there are some numbers being touted around. And one of the big things that people are saying is that, as you said, a water allocation is being framed or being marketed as a way for Aboriginal people to get into the economics of water. Those of you that have put in water licenses, because we still, Aboriginal people will still be expected to have a water license. Those of you listening out there who have got a water license know the level of rigor, but the level of investment you need to have a strategic Aboriginal, to have a water license. So from that perspective, you need to be able to have a business plan. You need to have all your science done. You need to be able to have the infrastructure. So we're talking about $3 to $5 million minimum to be able to get into the water market and to water allocation and water trading. So, you know, it sounds very interesting. And, you know, we haven't said no to this. One of the things we're saying is that, okay, if we're forced into a process of negotiating on a water allocation story, what would that look like? And because there's no certainty at any level of discourse or science at the national level, I'm saying, look, can we slow down a bit and really understand what we're talking about when we're talking about a strategic Aboriginal reserve? Because, as I said, there seems to be, you know, some barriers there. One, we have to get a water license. Two, we need to have capital behind us to be able to develop that reserve. Three, we either need to partner with an organisation or an entity or a business who does have the capital. The other point is we're talking about a river system that we have managed under Wurundjeri law or First Law from the beginning of time. So there's very, very clear that we have a law of obligation to firstly protect the river as a living entity and to protect our living water systems, because people are highly dependent on them, because our river doesn't flow all year round. It recedes into small billabongs and, you know, draws back into these living systems. So it's not like we've got a river flowing all year round. So I think a lot of this will be looking at how do we take, because we have an aversion to floodplain harvesting, because we know what floodplain harvesting will end up like, what we're saying is that, okay, if we're going to do this, how do we start to regulate the take, the monitoring, the regulations? And right now we have scenarios on country where a couple of people do have water licenses, and it's and they're applying for more water license to expand that. And we need to make sure these systems are merit-based. What did you do in terms of your previous water allocation? Did you show good water stewardship? Are there any issues that we think may be a barrier to increasing your water license? Like, these sorts of conversations are not on the table. So what we're saying is that let's make sure we have informed consent,
yep,
that we have rigor in terms of the scientific evidence, that if someone's coming in with a development project, that they show transparency and make their information available for peer review and for scrutiny.
Yep.
If it's going to not have any impact on people's lifeways and livelihoods, bring it on. If it is, then, you know, the word, people know what the word is, bugger off. But what we're saying is that we understand water is the new gold.
Yeah.
We understand that this is really the underlying intent is to look at water trading and water markets. And what we're saying is that I think there needs to be a lot more work done in terms of this, because part of the story is that if you're bringing in a good idea and you want to be able to sell it to the community, you need to bring the community with you. And at the moment, I don't think the community is with the government in terms of the direct intent. I mean, one of the things to also be of note is that 43,000 Australians wrote into the government and said, you need to proceed with caution and you need to slow down and there needs to be wider conversation on this. So my take is that we do all need to work together. I really strive very, very hard to create win-win. The prescribed body corporates or the native title bodies. I mean, one of the things that's come out from the Murrawarra Fitzroy River Council is our capacity to be a knowledge hub, to broker knowledge and wisdom and to share that with the PBCs. We are not looking at taking over the PBCs and, you know, running that they're the line that, oh, we're swallowing up PBCs or whatever. What we're doing is that we are brokering and generating knowledge so that we can provide that information to the prescribed body corporates, to the Kimberley Land Council, to the Kimberley Aboriginal Law and Culture Group, and to the Kimberley Aboriginal Language Group, because we believe that one of the big issues in all of this is providing evidence-based knowledge. So traditional owners and prescribed body corporates, native title groups can make informed decisions. So I just want to be very clear is that the Murrawarra Council was set up mainly to be a knowledge hub and a knowledge broker, not to take on the governance role of the prescribed body corporates or the native title groups. So that's very, very important to see ourselves as a brokerage model for those sorts of things, because it's very, very difficult and it costs a lot of money to generate evidence-based science. And so one of the things is this network that I've been able to mobilise from amazing people. As I said, I'm a member of visiting fellow to the Water Justice Hub, and they're doing great work and they're working in the Murray-Darling Basin, and they have been working in the Murray-Darling Basin for quite some time. So you've got eminent professors such as, you know, Professor John Williams, who's retired, but is so passionate about sharing his knowledge, and he continues to work with the Water Justice Hub, continues to work with us, the Murrawarra Council, so that we can understand, because seriously, I'm still, like you said, you know, where do they get those figures from? Where do they get those numbers from? And, you know, everyone, particularly in government, wants to tout the CSIRO report that said, oh, I think the take that from CSIRO was you possibly double the 300. So the government looks like they're coming down in terms of, you know, reducing the amount. But I think that the whole CSIRO report really needed to have a bit more, I guess, not transparency, but, you know, triangulation and peer review and really look at that. But as I said, I think the big thing is really how do we come up with some sort of statutory framework that's going to show that we have a duty of care to look after the river, but also that the brokerage and the knowledge would be managed through a collaborative way. So very, very important to get the governance and the leadership right. And I mean, I'm a Peter Cullen Fellow, so that actually means something. Peter Cullen was just an amazing water leader. He was able to, you know, move between the different power structures within government. You know, he worked very, very closely with both parties, and he was a real visionary for what water leadership, what water governance, what water stewardship should look like in our nation. So, as I said, you know, like, this is not just an emotional thing. I mean, definitely it is, but I, as a scientist, as a multidisciplinary science, I know the power and the necessity to have very good knowledge so that we can share with each other and indeed the world, because we're global citizens, about how do we look after this amazing place, the Marawara, the Fitzroy River, which has you know, immense global value and is right now, because of climate change, highly, highly stressed.
You said water is the new gold, which has really stuck with me. It's such a powerful and true statement, particularly in the context of a changing climate. It's such a valuable environmental asset, like not just in economic sense for water trading and markets, but as the core component to living for all of nature to survive. So it is very, very important to get the leadership and the governance right to ensure transparency, as you said, to ensure due process and to ensure that the Marawara does not suffer the same fate by learning from those lessons in the Murray-Darling Basin. So to have a vision led by Indigenous leaders and knowledge in that collaborative space with all parties is the ideal way forward. And I feel would be more trusted by all communities that precautions would be taken. So do you feel like Indigenous groups, with there being seven across the Marawara, are being given that opportunity?
Oh, look, I think one of the things is, as I said, you know, when the government first started to have this conversation 18 months ago prior to COVID, there were a number of meetings where government officials and, you know, ministers actually came to Fitzroy Crossing. I mean, it was a fairly, you know, closed meeting, but there seemed to be an intent to be in dialogue. And I hope that intent is still being carried through. But I guess one of the big things is, how do we get this right? And it's not just that I've got a that I see that we've got a problem. I actually see that there's a solution to this. And I'm not sure if you're aware, Janice, but there's a bioregional framework at a Commonwealth level that has mapped bioregions right across this nation, considering nature, natural, you know, nature reserve systems, catchment systems, all of this. And the system that has been mapped for the Fitzroy River, which would also include the communities on the peninsula, so that we would have a direct relationship between saltwater, freshwater interface, is known as the Dampier Lands. So that map is there. There's a framework there. There's a federal policy there. There's a policy that says that these are precious resources. The biodiversity that we're holding, the cultural diversity that we're holding, this amazing geographical and geological system is not found anywhere else on the planet. This is a globally unique river system. So we need to get it right. So part of what I'm saying, part of what I'm advocating is that why don't we have the resources to look at how a bioregional framework could work for the Fitzroy River, so that we can sit at the table, all of us. And one of the things I'm saying is that as traditional owners, we don't see ourselves as stakeholders. We see ourselves as shareholders.
Yep.
We have nearly 100% native title for the whole of the catchment. That actually means something in law and intent. So what we're saying is that we want to sit at the table. We want to come there. And what's really unique about the Fitzroy is that several years ago, we did have something called the Fitzroy Catchment Committee. And it was really, really interesting when it started, because there were people on there that, it was quite strange, really, because we had one pastoralist who had been actually shooting at Aboriginal people to get off his property, inverted commas. And then a week later, he's sitting in the room with the same people looking at how do we sit around the table and negotiate a way forward. So what we're saying is that we need to build trust. We need to build respect. And the history, the corporate history that I'm talking about, is the fact that the Fitzroy Catchment Committee, The Fitzroy Catchment Committee was there. It was a time when catchment management started to go out of vogue, so it didn't get investment to sustain it. But what that did was it showed us that people in the region with diverse views, diverse values, can come together and sit around the table and look at it from an evidence-based perspective and go, well, this is about the greater good of all of us. How do we sit around the table? How do we become better informed, one, by traditional knowledge, which I call Indigenous science, and two, by all the multiple layers of Western science? So how do we make these decisions in a collaborative way, in a cooperative way, where we have a unity pathway to share information and come to a better understanding of, okay, how will that development proceed? What do we need to do to develop a workforce to be able to live and work on country, particularly for Indigenous people. Yeah. We've seen that rangers have been such an amazing investment in terms of the ecosystem services that Aboriginal people provide. We've also seen, because I have had experience of being on the Australian Conservation Foundation, and there was the time I was there, they created positions called river keepers. And so what I'm saying is that why can't we develop up a workforce for Indigenous people, specifically trained and targeted to be the water regulators, to be on country, to travel around, to do the samples, to keep an eye on quality assurance of water systems. So, you know, there's a real way to create a win-win, one in terms of supporting Aboriginal people who are at the coalface of these sorts of development, but two, to create meaningful employment so that we can work together, so that we can manage and regulate this. So, you know, when I talked to you earlier, I said, look, we nearly make up 100% of the catchment with our native title. And some of the conversation around strategic Aboriginal reserves is that it needs to be land bounded. So if we own nearly 100% of the land, well, maybe we need to own 100% of the water.
Yeah.
So, you know, these are dialogues and these are conversations that if we're serious about seeing how water allocation can be an economic strategy to shift Aboriginal people from poverty to wealth creation, should we go down that process, then why is it so fanciful that Indigenous people can't have 100% of the water that's being allocated, so that we can start to look at how do we, one, put in practice the framework for determining what projects proceed and not proceed. So I think there's a lot of hope. There's a lot of good intent, but seriously, as I said, I live in the region. I live in a remote community, but Broome is also my home. So I also am in and out of Broome in terms of supplies and connection for flights and things like that. And what I'm saying is that very, very few people in the big towns, Fitzroy Crossing, Broome or Derby, actually know what is being proposed for the Fitzroy catchment. And I think there's a real duty of care to our people in the region about informing them of the intent of government and what this is being proposed to look like. And for us to sit around the table, and I'm really strongly advocating to strengthen the capacity of the Shire of Derby, local government. And I'm saying, well, if much of the development within the Fitzroy catchment is happening within the Shire of Derby, then how do we support the Shire of Derby to take on some sort of bioregional framework and invest in that as a local government capacity, so that we've got a broader representation of people in the region that can sit around the table? So there's great leadership, you know, with the Shire president who's there, and, you know, the CEO. And I think people have, as I said, an intent and a goodwill to look at this, because everybody is struggling in terms of what are the new economies, how can they come into vogue. And so what I'm saying is that I think there's a capacity there to set up a very good governance and water leadership role to look at how we strengthen the capacity of the Shire of Derby to be, in a way, leading some of this conversation, because as the Shire, they also have an Indigenous community engagement strategy that they're engaging with multiple numbers of the Aboriginal group. So it seems to be right there. There's a need for the Shire of Derby to start to look at new economies. And I'm not sure if you've seen, but there was an article I published in the ACF called Looking at Knowledge Brokerage around what we call the forever industries. So looking at culture, conservation, science, tourism, education, that this is an amazing place. I don't know if the listeners are aware, but this, when Nelson Mandela was alive, he set up a global concept called geoparks. And geoparks have taken off across the world, and they're amazing places. It's almost like how the bird people fly around and go and watch birds at different places. Geopark people chase geoparks across the world because they have a fascination with the geology and the geography and how the country is place-based and generates its own unique biodiversity and cultural diversity. So geoparks are there. Bioprospecting, we haven't really touched on that in our country in terms of Indigenous plants, Indigenous knowledge, Indigenous wisdom, that we have plants on the river country that have immense value to humanity. How do we get the patents right? How do we get copyright right? How do we get benefit sharing? So there are real ways to come together and look at what are the new economies, because at the moment, one of the big problems with this story is that there's no cumulative impact assessment on what the potential risks and demands on water are going to be projected over the next 3 to 10 years.
Yeah.
That on one hand, we're saying, oh, we want to grow cotton or fodder for intensive cattle. And yet on the other hand, we're saying, well, let's frack the crap out of the Canning Basin and see what we can do. And it makes me really, really nervous about fracking the Canning Basin, because I've been watching fracking, well, you know, coal seam gas on the other side of the country, and what's happened with contamination of beef and dairy and, you know, amazing thoroughbred horses.
Yeah.
And, you know, people not having baseline data and then not being able to determine when did that potential contamination start. I've been looking at stuff across the US and in Europe, and it's quite frightening, fracking. Coal seam gas, you're going down 500 metres. Fracking over here for shale gas, what we're talking about is going possibly 5 to 6 kilometres. And once we start to fracture the bedrock and destabilise all of the geological structures and start to destabilize the foundation of that, we're going to see more and more frequencies of, you know, earthquakes and earth tremors. And it's been really, really interesting to look at the increase of earthquakes in the Kimberley in the last 10 years and the frequency and the intensity of those. And so what I'm saying is that it just seems to be open slather. Australia seems to be continuously failing in terms of its due diligence and duty of care to the world to, you know, transition from fossil fuels to renewables. The government policies, the government investment is so backward,
yeah,
that it's really making it difficult for people who want to be entrepreneurial in the green energy space or the fossil, you know, moving away from fossil fuels. So at the moment, we're sending very, very mixed messages to the world in terms of our duty of care as planetary citizens to look after, you know, the world in its entirety. And it just seems to be business as usual. And right now, as a traditional owner in the Kimberleys, it seems to be a rapid onslaught to try and get these big fossil fuel projects up before someone says, oh, slow down. So, you know, there's a lot happening. And I'm saying that we can't afford chaos. We need to do business differently. There is a great opportunity and a goodwill to sit at the table and to look at how do we do this differently, and to start to look at how do we invest. So, you know, some of the catch cry is, oh, we need to have these sorts of developments so we can have increased employment for Aboriginal people. We know what works. Yep. Fund more ranger programs. Fund more ranger programs. Get more ecosystems happening. Look at, you know, sharing this amazing place. Like, I can't believe that I'm a 65-year-old woman and I'm still just learning about different places on my country.
Yeah.
One of the things I've been doing recently with amazing communications team is mapping song lines across the Fitzroy River. And we're just in we've just got a little project at the moment for my IATSES. This is a personal one. But we were following the song lines and we went to an amazing place, which is so close to my grandmother's country. And there was this huge lake there and it was just filled with every kind of bird you could think of. And then in the background was the St. George Range that I was telling you about. And it was just like a snapshot in a moment in time of just seeing how amazing the river system is. It is globally unique. I mean, the birds in the Kimberley, I think we have possibly 40 to 50% of Australia's bird population. So there's lots of different economies that we can come up with and really invest in, which will be low impact, but will continue to allow our living waters to flow. So I think it's time to sort of in 2021 to not other Indigenous people and other Indigenous leadership, but look at what does place-based governance really look like? How can we bring in a bioregional framework to look at the connectivity between the communities on the peninsula and in the Fitzroy River? How can we sit down and go, okay, what are the predicted large-scale fossil fuel development? What is that impact? How is it going to do these sorts of things? Because I'm really fearful that what could happen is that, you know, one of the things that we have as Indigenous people, we go, oh, nobody speaks for somebody else's country, but water has no boundary.
Yeah.
Water has no boundary. So if you're going to frack on your land, then it's going to impact and run down into the Fitzroy River or run sideways onto the Indigenous communities on the peninsula, then you need to proceed with caution, because it's highly likely that if somebody can prove that what you are doing is going to cause foreseeable harm, then there could be Indigenous people taking other Indigenous people to court, because we believe that there could be an intent to say this is not the right way to proceed. So it's a really, really interesting place, the Fitzroy River. It's an amazing place. It is globally unique. I mean, the diversity of culture here is just not found anywhere else on the planet. And we need to sort of think about how do we do business differently, because Aboriginal people are saying, we want all projects on the table. Nothing's to be excluded. We're not saying no to anything, but it must be something that's not going to impact on our lifeways, our living water, with the environment, or on human health.
Yeah.
So well-being is a real critical element that we need to look at.
I couldn't agree more, but unfortunately we're going to have to start wrapping up. But before we do,
I'd like to sort of connect people through to, and you were saying this is also, we can see this on the Marawara Fitzroy Council's website, but the docu-series on the voices on the Marawara, which follows, 10 traditional owners, and their sort of fight to protect the waterway from large-scale intensive water extraction proposal that was part of the managing water in the Fitzroy catchment paper. Is there anything that you'd like to share to let listeners know about in terms of the docuseries itself or the website or other external related content that they can go and find out more and stay subscribed to this story?
Yeah, no, stay subscribed to the story. One of the things I mentioned is that we're looking to have an event on World Water Day on the 26th of September. So we'll be looking to screen The Serpent's Tale, which is a very large documentary, a very beautiful and powerful documentary made by an amazing man, Mark Jones, in collaboration with traditional owners. So it's a very, very beautiful film. And we'll also share some of the songline that we've been mapping along the Fitzroy River, because it'll give viewers an opportunity to come and see country. And that's one of the things as a filmmaker, is I feel that film is such a powerful way to tell a story and bring the people with us. I think one of the things that we need to do is part of this is I call wake up the snake. Wake up the snake means how do we wake up the consciousness of the people to bring the people with us? So I think what's happening at the moment is that there is a national conversation to be had. It's being had at the federal level and trickling down to the state. And the point that I want to leave is that we need to be moving away from just talking about Indigenous interest in water to actual water rights for Indigenous people in water. So this is not about us locking up the system. This is about us developing a governance mechanism that's going to ensure that these living water systems, these amazing rivers that we have in our nation, particularly the Fitzroy River, as I said, is national heritage, belongs to everybody. It's the largest Aboriginal cultural heritage site in Western Australia. So it definitely belongs to the world as world heritage. And we just want to do this differently. We want to learn from the Murray-Darling Basin. And we're so grateful to all the wonderful work that's come out of it. We have a way of moving forward. Let's move forward with the spirit of intent, of goodwill, but most of all, the need to ensure that the law of obligation for the Fitzroy River to not only live, but the right of that river to live and flow.
Exactly. Thank you so much for joining us today. And it has been literally a real pleasure, and so much learning has occurred for myself and hopefully for all our listeners as well. So we really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, no, thank you for your work too, Janice. I mean, river basins are really, you know, the hub of everything we're talking about, because, you know, water is alive. Water is life, and we need to make sure it stays alive. So thank you for your work, and thank you for what, you know, the River Basin Management mob do. And thank you for privileging voices like, you know, myself on your space. And I think it's a case of watch this space, because as I said, the Fitzroy River does belong to all of us, and we need to have a duty of care to love that river, fall in love with your living water systems wherever you are in Australia, and get to spend time in nature. Thank you, Janice. Kalia Mabu. Thank you, listeners.
Thank you so much. Thank you again for joining us on the RBMS streaming podcast today. And thank you to our listeners for joining us in this conversation on the future of the Murrawarra Fitzroy River with Dr. Anne Paulina. If you found this episode informative or you have any feedback, please share, please like, or send us your thoughts on our social media pages. And to stay up to date on the future of the Murrawarra Fitzroy River, please head to the website and stay tuned for the next episode as well. Thanks again.